Welcome to the October podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pynchon. The October issue is on the topic of complications of spine surgery and management strategies. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Patrick Shea of the University of Southern California, Los Angeles, speaks with Dr. John Liu of Cedars-Sinai Spine Center in Los Angeles.
Welcome to the October issue of Neurosurgery Focus podcast. The current topic that we have today is complication of spine surgery and management strategies. My name is Patrick Shea. I'm one of the co-editors of this issue. I'm from University of Southern California Department of Neurosurgery in Los Angeles. Today we have an honor of having John Liu, who's the director of Neurosurgery Spine Program at Cedars-Sinai Department of Neurosurgery, with us, and we'll be talking to him about his insights on minimally invasive spine surgery and complications associated with a particular procedure known as the transpsoas minimally invasive lateral approach, which he is one of the contributing authors for. John, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Patrick.
So, John, I'd like to start out just by asking you to give the readers a background of the minimally invasive lateral lumbar approach, and if you could just give a little historic background and provide us some discussion on sort of the indications for the procedure and which patients are suitable for this type of treatment.
Certainly. Minimally invasive lateral approach has been around, I would say, probably about 8 years now. Kind of went through a bunch of different evolution. Even over the last 20 years, there were many folks doing this lateral approach where you're trying to gain access to the anterior inner body space. Initially, it was done more through a traditional open approach, and then it went through some phases where they used CO2 gas techniques to help open up the retroperitoneal space. And it's not until more recently when we actually developed these tubular approach or minimally invasive approach, which is gasless, that helps reach the lateral spine. And so that is the approach that we're talking about here in terms of this paper, in terms of the potential complications that can occur. With this anatomy, we do have to go through the psoas muscle, which basically lies lateral in the lumbar spine. And so this is a trans-iliopsoas muscle approach to the lateral disc space through a minimally invasive approach. The indications for this is anytime you want to do an inner body access for fusion, and you can reach pretty much any part of the lateral lumbar spine at any level, with the exception of the L5-S1. And there are a number of anatomical barriers to reach the lateral L5-S1, but pretty much the other levels are fairly accessible.
Just to summarize, basically the procedure is a retroperitoneal approach in the retroperitoneum and going through the psoas and approaching the spine laterally. And as I recall, historically, you were one of the early authors on minimally invasive lateroscopic anterior approach to the lumbar spine. And can you describe why this approach is different to that? And that procedure obviously has gone out of favor. And why is this any different than that particular approach?
Certainly. The anterior approach, which is essentially an ALIF, is an anterior lumbar inner body fusion. One of our early papers that was published in the early 2000s described the laparoscopic approach to the anterior spine. It's a different operation. It's an operation that we still will use today, but primarily for L5-S1. I think that's a great operation for a number of different reasons, just in terms of the ability to get a large interbody graft through that direct anterior approach in terms of help restore lordosis and indirectly decompress the foramen. So there's a lot of advantages of putting in a large graft. Now, to work more rostral with an anterior approach becomes more of a difficult operation in a sense that you have to move large vessels to get to the spine, and oftentimes you have to do a more oblique approach. So that's why the lateral approach or the minimally invasive lateral became more favorable, because truly it's a minimally invasive access. You have a single small incision, typically less than 3 centimeters. You're taking advantage of retroperitoneal space, and overall my sense is it's a better way to go. It's in terms of if you want to reach the upper part of the lumbar spine. When I say the upper part, I think anything above L4-5 can be reached through this approach. Now, L4-5 can be done as well, but there is slightly increase in the amount of risk of potential complications.
Now, from a day-to-day clinical scenario for, you know, the spine surgeons, whether orthopedic or neurosurgeons, what type of disease process do you think would be ideal for this type of procedure?
I would say any time you're thinking about doing a fusion or interbody fusion, the direct lateral becomes an approach that you can think of. I will use this for like a spondylolisthesis, a adjacent level degeneration next to a prior fusion. We actually use this approach quite often for our deformity patients where they actually have a flat back or positive sagittal balance or they have degenerative scoliosis. From this approach, it's a powerful way to help correct some of that coronal deformity and actually help us correct some of the sagittal imbalance as well, although probably not as powerful as a coronal correction. So I think in the end, anytime you're thinking about doing an interbody fusion, this potentially is, it's a technique that you can consider.
And I guess with all the alternatives, treatment available, why would interbody fusion sort of be favored, and what are some of its advantages associated with this procedure?
Right. I think in terms of interbody fusion itself, there are a number of different advantages. It can help you correct deformity, and it increases overall fusion rate. You can indirectly decompress the neural foramen. You can probably indirectly decompress some of the central canal stenosis if it's more mostly ligamentous stenosis. If you can get a large enough graft, you can actually help you reduce spondylolisthesis. So there's a lot of advantages. I guess the question really comes down, why do a minimally invasive lateral as opposed to a posterior PLIF or TLIF type of procedure, which I think they're fine procedure as well. But I do think there are certain advantages going from a lateral just because you can get, you have the advantages of doing an ALIF, meaning that you can get a really nice size cage in that space. And I think that larger size cage that you can span the entire end plate and rest your cage on the outer layer of the end plate, which is the strongest part of the end plate. I think in a number of scenarios when people have osteopenia or osteoporosis, I tend to favor using this approach as opposed to more of a PLIF or a TLIF, which is a smaller cage. The other advantage, I think, is that if you don't have to decompress the spinal canal, going from a lateral approach, you don't have to expose the canal at all. So I think you decrease the risk of potential adverse effects of having to cross the spinal canal or the posterior foramen.
Sure, sure. Those are all excellent points. And I understand that you were also the senior author on a separate paper that was recently published in JNS Spine on the ability of this approach to correct regional and segmental alignment for the lumbar spine in the setting of deformity. And could you just comment briefly about that?
Yes. So with a lateral approach, because of the size of the implant that you can get and the way that you can get the implant in, we found that it was a powerful means of correcting coronal deformities. So in somebody who has degenerative scoliosis, this is a great way to help you correct that deformity. You can also help yourself in terms of sagittal correction. That we found to be advantageous, more on a regional, but not necessarily on a global correction. So if you use a minimally invasive approach laterally, we did not find that by itself help correct a global sagittal imbalance. My sense is you probably have to do some additional work either posteriorly to release that facet joint or do some type of osteotomy to help additional correction if your patient has a lot of sagittal imbalance or a flat back. So I think those are the things that we found from our data.
That's great. That has corroborated with certainly my personal experience and many of the spine surgeons around the country that it appears that because of the size of the cage where you're able to span across the disc space on a coronal plane, that it's really a powerful tool to correct coronal deformity. But a lot of the sagittal imbalance because of the limitation of the orientation and the sagittal alignment of the graft, the ability to correct segmental lordosis, although there is some correction on a global level, this is not widely appreciated to be a major factor. And I think your paper certainly illustrates that point very elegantly. In terms of this procedure, are there complications that people should be worried about? And what are some of the potential complications from this procedure?
This is a trans-ileal psoas approach, and if you think about the anatomy, your lumbar plexus essentially runs in the posterior half of your psoas muscle. And so when you go in trans-psoas, there's a risk of potentially injuring the lumbar plexus. There are a number of anatomical studies that has come out recently. I think the one that's been out there the longest is the Morrow paper. And Dr. Morrow looked at cadaveric specimens, and that demonstrated nicely that the lumbar plexus is predominantly in the posterior half. Now, L4-5, it's a little bit trickier because sometimes that lumbar plexus or the leading edge of the lumbar plexus, which is essentially the obturator or the femoral nerve, is can course fairly anteriorly. The technique itself is taught to try to stay at least within the anterior half of the lateral disc space. But at L4-5, sometimes that can be a problem, too, because of the course of the femoral nerve. So I think a nerve injury is certainly a potential morbidity from this operation. That is why intraoperative neuromonitoring, both with a trigger as well as free-run EMG, is done to try to lessen the risk. And there are some other techniques that you can also use. And one of the things we briefly described in the paper is what we've been going towards more is what's called a shallow docking technique, where we actually dock on top of the psoas muscle and visually go through the psoas, as opposed to using these sequential dilators going through the psoas pretty much on a blinded basis. So I've kind of stopped doing that. I basically docked on top of the psoas muscle and walked through the psoas either with a pinfield 4 or with a bipolar, and you can actually see all the nerves. I just did an operation 2 days ago where we actually saw a general femoral coursing nerve, and then a couple of operations prior, we actually saw the femoral nerve. And both of these were done at L4-5. So I think the lumbar plexus injury certainly is probably the most concerning. The second potential complication that we've addressed in this paper is that overall the trans psoas morbidity, predominantly from just working through the psoas muscle, and you can get some edema in the psoas, perhaps some hematoma. The post-op complaints of an anterior thigh, groin region pain, numbness, and potentially even psoas weakness, I think the incidence of that is it's not low. And that's what was brought up in this paper, where upwards of 38% of folks will complain of some type of weakness in their psoas. But the important thing is that everybody gets better, at least from what we can see in our population, in terms of those particular symptoms. So I think those are more of a transient type of symptom. But it is important to keep in mind and to let the patients know. And in my personal experience, I think if the patients, if you let the patients know and they're aware that this is just part of the operation, they're fine with it. They don't complain. But if they don't know before going into the operation, all of a sudden they have this new symptom, then they can get quite concerned about this. So to sum up, the lumbar plexus injury as well as the overall trans psoas muscle kind of working through that muscle injury are probably the two biggest problems that we would see.
Sure, and I think a lot of complications have also arise from sensory disturbances and sensory complaints. How do you manage that type of problem since Mueller Volk EMG isn't necessarily going to detect that type of complication?
Right, that's a very good point. Most of these numbness and sometimes little groin region pain, we're not quite sure what the exact cause of that is. The thinking is that this may be a component of a lumbar plexus kind of sensory injury. It could be a couple of the smaller nerves that course through the psoas muscle, one of which that people talk about all the time is called the general femoral nerve. And these are all potential nerves that can be injured in addition to other nerves that course through the psoas. Most of these that we found have not been a long-term problem. If it's a short-term issue in terms of these gnawing, discomfort, or pain, typically what I'll do is to start the patient on some type of medication to reduce nerve type pains. And these can include a gabapentin or Elavil or Lyrica. And usually these are short-course treatments. And I think the reassuring the patient that this is not unexpected, I think that's probably more important than anything else.
Sure. Now, I would agree that I think majority of the patients do improve and return fairly back to normal, but even based on your study, it appears that by the time of 6 months, there were still a significant number of people that are not back to normal. Do you think these people ever get back to normal, or do they kind of live with this permanently?
My sense is by 6 months, if you're still having some issues, likely those are probably more permanent type of issues. And I think the way that this study was done was that this was a self-reported survey. Most of the papers out there that talks about this type of approach. Typically, it's from the surgeon's perspective. And so the complication rate, my sense, it hasn't been really reported to the full effect. I think when patients feel that they have some issues going on, my sense is a little bit more accurate, just because they can say, hey, listen, I actually have this numbness, whereas the doctors may or may not include that as part of their exam and their subsequent follow-up notes. What I found is that it doesn't affect the patient. They're really not bothered by it. These are things that we actually have to ask the patient. When they come in, they're not coming in saying my thigh is numb or this is painful. We actually have to ask them to see if that's a problem. And if they really think about it, they say, oh yeah, you know, I have some numbness here, but you know, it doesn't really bother me. I just part of what I how I feel on a day in day out basis.
Sure. I think historically, just based on the number of publications that's been reported for this procedure, there is a trend that we're seeing more and more reported complications as a result of this procedure. Early on, this procedure was touted as a procedure of very, very little complication. In fact, almost no complications were being reported initially. And over the past several years, certainly people have alluded to the complications related, particularly to the L4-5 interspace, where there are seeing a number of quadriceps, palsies, and that are actually more than transient weakness, and certainly a lot of the inguinal and thigh pain that you've described. I think that's one of the goals of this issue, is to address some of the underreporting of the complication and sort of help surgeons and patients understand that these are really part of the treatment morbidity associated with, many of which are related just to the approach of surgery alone, as you described, going through the psoas and going through the space where, very delicate lumbar plexus nerve roots reside. So I think you're making all very excellent points here. One more thing I'd like to touch upon before we conclude this is, what about the complications related to structures that neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons may not be as familiar with? For example, the visceral retroperitoneal structures. How does one avoid urinary injury, bowel injuries, and vascular injury, which have all been reported?
Those are all potential complications that can occur with this approach. The good thing is, I think they're relatively low, at least if you look at all the studies that's out there. You just have to really be vigilant and know what structures are around there. And if they're working truly in the retroperitoneal space and making sure you sweep forward on the peritoneum, and as you dock your tube down, to not to pinch off a small piece of the peritoneum, and I think that's going to be key. Part of the reason I switched to the shallow docking technique is that when I look down and I'm seeing the surface of the psoas muscle, I know there's nothing there. I know there's no fold of a peritoneum that's got caught between the tube and the psoas muscle. So I think for me, that's a sense of a reassurance that, well, I'm not going to cause a bowel injury. In terms of the ureter typically we don't see, but it's in that vicinity. It's more anterior along the psoas. And again, I think the shallow docking, if it's right around there, you're going to be able to see it. In terms of vascular injury, I think the most problematic would be either the iliac or the vena cava, in that you can potentially catch. And what we do, basically, it's important when you're doing the procedure to be meticulous in terms of working within the disc space as well as working perpendicular to the disc space, so you're not skiving anterior and posterior. And there's safeguards in terms of using fluoroscopy to make sure you're not too anterior, securing your working tube so it doesn't migrate. A lot of different techniques to try to reduce that. But I think overall, the incidences are quite low for those other type of injuries that can occur.
Sure. Those are all very excellent technical pointers. And if I could just ask you one last question, what do you think is the future for this procedure? Are there any areas of research and future direction that you think will continue to improve this procedure and allow surgeons to help our patients?
There's been an explosion in terms of the number of different systems that's out there now. It seems that almost every vendor has a lateral approach system, but it really kind of all falls in the same concept of neuromonitoring and working trans psoas. And I think you may get a little difference in terms of implants. My sense is perhaps changing the technique to a certain degree. Again, we commented about the shallow docking as one potential in terms of trying to hopefully reduce some of the morbidity. People are looking at different implants, perhaps coming in with a smaller implant as opposed to a large implant to try to reduce some of that window on the psoas muscle. Perhaps in the future there may be some advancement in terms of neuromonitoring that helps us pick up lumbar plexus or even the sensory components. People are looking at different ways to get to the spine, perhaps from a more oblique approach versus a more direct lateral approach. So I think there's certainly a lot of different things that we're looking at this point, but I think the important thing is if this is a technique, which I do think is a powerful technique for a number of different operations, that the surgeon understands the anatomy that he or she is working around and that you understand how to avoid problems. I think overall it's a very safe procedure, but there are certain drawbacks that the surgeon has to be aware of.
Thank you, John. Thank you for your candid reporting of a very difficult topic that's generally for surgeons on complications related to surgery for your patients. And I also want to thank you for your insight and for your time in this podcast. And I think we'll conclude our podcast at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes our podcast for the October issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the November issue, when the topic will be adult and pediatric sports injuries. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. You can also follow the JNS on Twitter.